Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to another episode of Your Case is on Hold. I'm Antonia Chen, deputy editor of JBJS. Recovering from the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeon meeting still. And you are?
I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods at JBJS. This is the holiday season, of course. It's upon us. So hopefully all the orthopedic readers have been good this year so that they get handed out cases ready to go and not cases that are on hold. I've heard that you, Antonia, will be visited this year by three ghosts: the ghost of JBJS editor past, the ghost of JBJS editor present, and the ghost of JBJS editor yet to come. So the past would be Dr. Heckman with his editor's pen, like completely rewriting your paper after it was accepted. And then present will be Dr. Swinkowski discussing your paper with Dr. Bhandari on Ortho Joe. And the ghost of JBJS editor-in-chief future is probably the scariest one of all.
Is it a robot?
That's a good guess. Maybe it will be a robot. An awesome Christmas present. My JBJS editor-in-chief robot. It's like, this paper's terrible.
Reject. Cut.
You're like a Dickensian orphan. You're like, please, sir, can we discuss the orthopedic research now?
So much to look forward to. As you can tell in this podcast, these opinions are clearly our own and do not represent anyone else in the JBJS editorial board or in JBJS. We are sponsored by JBJS clinical classrooms. They are seeking orthopedic surgeons with 5 years of experience following residency or fellowship to join the team. So if you are interested, please email customersupport@jbjs.org to learn more. Without further ado,
but at the end of the meeting with the editor-in-chief of JBJS Future, you'll be like, I'm so sorry. I don't want my papers discussed on your cases on hold. I won't overfit my statistical models. I won't say it's level 2 evidence because it was prospectively collected retrospective data. I'll properly grade it as level 4.
That's right. Be careful of the wrath of your cases on hold. Dun, dun, dun. Well, on the opposite side of wrath, we can talk about top of the pile. What good things do we have that are top of the pile that we like to highlight here?
So many holiday treats.
Ooh, it is. It's like those nuggets that you find in your stocking. Hopefully not coal, though.
Right. I don't know what nuggets you're getting in your stocking.
Like Hershey nuggets, you know, those like chocolate nuggets. I'm a sugar junkie, so I can't say anything besides sugar stuff. So top of the pile, low molecular weight heparin is superior to aspirin in prevention of thromboembolic disease, or is it? This is by Parvizi et al., and this is a commentary in response to the Australian study that was done in low molecular weight heparin versus aspirin in preventing thrombotic disease in total joint arthroplasty patients. What's new in musculoskeletal basic science? These are great highlights that we have. Google et al. This is also permanently free, just like the one from Parvizi is permanently free. What's important? The challenge in diagnosing frozen shoulder after COVID-19 vaccination. This is by Sahu et al., and it's also permanently free. And the impact of orthopedic surgeons on National Institutes of Health funding for hip and knee arthroplasty research by Silvestre. Without further ado, we will go on to our headlines. Would you like to kick us off, please?
Yeah, I just want to point out that in the epic holiday movie Christmas Vacation, the grandfather says, I have to eat so I can take my back pill. He doesn't say, I have to take my knee pill or my hip pill. It says back pill.
So back pill is still number
spine
one.
Problem.
Because it doesn't go away. Even after spine surgery, you still need the back pill.
Oh, that's what it is. Right. Clark gifted him bilateral knee replacements for the Christmas previous.
Exactly.
That we're discussing for my headline is Outcomes of Posterior Spinal Fusion in Pediatric Patients with Down Syndrome by Fraser and colleagues. As many are aware, Down syndrome is a challenging medical condition with multiple medical issues and manifestations, including several that are orthopedic. Scoliosis is actually fairly high in this population, and that's not something that's sort of like the conventional bullet points that you get when you're memorizing, you know, the orthopedic manifestations of Down syndrome for step one, step two, the board exams, et cetera. But there's a fairly high prevalence of scoliosis in this population, somewhere between 5 to, you know, short of 10%. And the outcomes for surgery in this clinical context have not been especially well investigated. So this was a multi-center effort, combination between Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And syndrome who were treated with spinal fusion over a decade, essentially 2009 to 2019, and, you know, essentially looked at outcomes. They only have 23 patients in total between the three centers, so is a fairly rare entity, as we recognize. Almost all of the patients had one or more medical comorbidities. 70% had congenital heart disease. 88% had previous cardiac surgery. So these are high-risk patients. They're medically frail patients. And consequently, perhaps not surprisingly, there is a high risk of postoperative complications, about 50%, including implant failure, pulmonary complications, wound dehiscence, surgical site infections, pseudoarthrosis. So ultimately, you know, as compared to historic literature, complications are more frequent in this population than in children who have adolescent idiopathic scoliosis and do not have Down syndrome. And the complication rate is certainly higher than, you know, would be considered standard for that average case. Obviously, these are from three centers that are highly specialized. It's over the course of the last decade. So there's a potential for selection, indication, cluster bias, expertise bias, however you want to look at it. There's not a lot of literature on this particular issue, which is why I think that it certainly warranted publication in JBJS. It's a very interesting paper, but again, a very small sample. Interestingly, I think that all of these folks must have been very good this year because they were received a holiday gift of a rating of level 3 evidence, which to me, this is as level 4 as level 4 can get. Outside of that, I mean, of course, it's just, it's their experience. There's nothing to really, you know, put on hold or anything along those lines. And then it's just, you know, the translational aspects, I think, depending on your center or how your center performs relative to these three centers, that's, you know, sort of the only part that I guess would continue to be open discussion at this point. But certainly, I think food for thought for surgeons and things that, you know, you can kind of put your hand on, hang your hat on when discussing preoperatively making a decision with family, giving them some context about what to expect in the near postoperative period.
Completely agree. I commend the authors for highlighting a topic. And it's one of those things where there's just not enough patients, but we have to highlight what we have so we have data to work on. So I agree with that. I'm going to pivot a little bit and shift from patients to providers. So now I'm going to shift to surgeons and the risk of noise-induced hearing loss for orthopedic surgeons. And this is something, but this is by Kwan et al. And there's a commentary as well. Again, if you don't agree with me, you can listen to someone else's commentary. It's also free for 30 days. And this is something that I've been beating on the drum of for some time, because if you walk around and talk to your total joint colleagues, a lot of times they say, "What? Huh?" And they come to you and they can't hear well. And so this group of authors looked at noise and in the operating room, and they didn't actually correlate it to hearing loss, right? So that's the one biggest thing I would say that would have been nice to see, is test the surgeons who were in the operating room who were being exposed to this noise, but they look at the threshold of noise. And OSHA defines noise exposure as hazardous if you're exposed to a time-weighted average, and they use TWA throughout the article, of 90 decibels over an 8-hour period. So if you're getting a continuous stream of noise over 8 hours, over 90 decibels, that's truly problematic. But if you're at 89, that's also not good either. But that's the OSHA definition of it as well. So what I like about this is that the authors wanted to budget different operating rooms and sample noise in a different setting. So, you know, they looked at hand, foot and ankle, shoulder and elbow, spine, sports medicine, adult reconstruction. And of course, we all know that there's different procedures throughout these different subspecialties, but it's good at least to get a representation in not just one area. And they went into the operating room with no one around and got some background ambient noise. Now, the anesthesia machine is still on, but nothing else is on. And we know we're all... guilty of doing things like listening to music, having loud power tools. And this is what drew us to orthopedics in the first place. But at the same time can have a hazardous side effect of noise. So they found out that the procedure with the highest noise dose was a microdiscectomy. And I thought you'd appreciate that as a spine guy, because you can see that it reached 11.3% of the maximum allowable daily dose and a projected dose of 104%. So congratulations, you guys overachieved and went above and beyond. Among the subspecialties, though, probably not surprisingly, adult reconstruction, the highest average dose per case. And then the cases that exceeded that total weighted average of 75 decibels was knee arthroplasty, laminectomy, and microdiscectomy. So between our two subspecialties, we're not doing so well in the noise department. The maximum level, the highest level, was actually for total hip arthroplasty, which I found kind of surprising, because if I think about total hip arthroplasty and I think about using the saw, we only really use it for the femoral neck cut, but you know, broaching, acetabular hitting, anything that we do throughout the case is actually quite loud. So total knee arthroplasty, total hip arthroplasty, and laminectomy were the highest ones. And then they looked at doses, case, and they did projected dose. So they broke this down into three different areas. And, you know, the maximum level obviously only being part of it, and how much sustained time that was in these areas would also is something to look at as well, too. So take-home message from this is that there's a few things that are that the authors did note that were not ideal in these settings. These weren't standardized operating rooms, right? They weren't the same size operating room, same number of patients, same number of people in the operating room. All sorts of variables that can absorb noise or determine how much noise is present in these settings. The speaker was placed on the individual who was doing the procedure. So, you know, whether or not that was the only person it would affect noise-wise, no, that's the ones that are closest to the tools. But obviously, there's different variables when it comes to noise in the room. I'm glad they did not put a speaker or a detector, you know, for example, like under the table or from up top and the bottom. It's actually by the actual individual itself that could potentially correlate to noise loss. It does not say what equipment was used. You know, for example, if there's, you know, different technologies, we're back to the robot again, or, you know, other things in the room that could contribute to noise. And then we didn't know which steps were loudest. And I think, of course, as the surgeons, we want to know which steps should we potentially avoid, or which steps can we improve to make the noise less. And finally, again, I like to see a correlation of this with individuals and their actual hearing. But those are longitudinal studies that can be conducted, and at least this is a good foray into the occupational hazards of being an orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah, I think it's definitely an area that is not really thought about. So bring this to the attention of the community. I think that's the highest value provided by this article. I think some areas have probably more capacity for generalization or translation than others. For example, I think, and I'm not really trying to defend the fact that microdiscectomy or a spine surgical procedure had the highest score or what have you. But I think that's going to be very provider or procedure dependent. So some people will use burrs to shave down the lamina. As you said, it's not really clear exactly, you know, how these procedures were done. That's really the only way that I can reconcile a lot of noise exposure during a spine surgery case such as this. I have to assume it's coming from the use of a burr, because if you're using just rongeurs or, you know, other instruments, they're not really making a lot of noise. The noise comes from, as you say, from either saw, drill, and some people do use drills for pedicle screws and things like that. But again, this is a microdiscectomy, so there aren't pedicle screws being placed. So that one, I think, is probably provider dependent and not translational across all discectomy or microdiscectomy procedures. I do think that probably the arthroplasty cases, you know, how they're done in one place is very similar to how they're done in others. And it's the use of the bone saws and then the, you know, mallet to hammer in, prepare the femur, prepare the acetabulum, and all of those components. So something else to consider in terms of occupational safety in the OR.
But you bring up a good point in that it would be very interesting to compare the noise levels in those two settings. And then those who, you know, use the burr may say, hey, it might be worth my hearing to do use Ronjur in those settings, right? So potentially giving them different metrics by say, and they highlighted this too, and that shoulder surgery, for example, shoulder surgery is a broad category. You could have a scope or you could have a total shoulder arthroplasty, right? So those two different areas are very different, and maybe how we do things in one way might be beneficial in another way. But we're obviously looking only at sound as a variable. There's multiple other variables that go into how what technique you do to do surgery. So
yeah, and this is the gift of occupational safety in the operating room, which just like JBJS, Clark, is the gift that keeps on giving the whole year long.
Can't stop, won't stop. All right, tell us about arthroscopic rotator cuff repair with and without acromioplasty in the treatment of full thickness rotator cuff tears. Long-term outcomes of a multi-center randomized control trial by Woodmess et al. Again, there's a commentary for this one. There's a visual summary for this, and it's free for 30 days. What are your take on this, Professor?
That's a trifecta of highlights for this particular. This is your case is on hold. And why is your case on hold, Todd? I don't know, Margot. Why is the carpet all wet? So this study is a follow-on study from original work conducted between 2003 and 2011. So they're looking at patients now between 2015 and 2021 who originally had participated in the initial randomized controlled trial, long-term follow-up, determining efficacy of subacromial decompression in patients with full thickness rotator cuff tear. That's the convention. They were randomized to either acromioplasty or not. So the first thing is that they had 86 patients originally, of which the group without acromioplasty, 31 of 45 were retained for this work. And then in the group with acromioplasty, 25 of 41. Now, these are non-negligible numbers lost to follow-up. These are, you've got 14 patients in one group and 16 in the other. So 30 of 86 patients are not completing this follow-on investigation. 16% of the 45 patients in the group without acromioplasty eventually needed reoperation in the long-term follow-up, while only one patient in the acromioplasty group underwent reoperation. And all those patients who underwent a reoperation had a type 2 or 3 acromion. So I think obviously the study is very valuable. There's not a lot of, methodologic nitty-gritty to work through here because it's a follow-on to a randomized study. They're looking at these bivariate comparisons and observations. Patients who underwent rotator cuff repair, regardless of whether or not they had acromioplasty, by and large, had improvement of their outcomes. And these were very durable out to 11 years average follow-up. So I think that's a great win for the field as a whole and the subspecialty of shoulder surgery, and no differences in patient-reported outcomes. So where they really want to, hang their hat is higher reoperation rate observed in patients with rotator cuff repair without acromioplasty, especially pay attention to the type 2 or 3 acromion. And I think that that's fine, but these are very small numbers on which to base this determination. You're talking about one patient in one group and seven patients in the other group. And they say 7 of the 45 patients, but they don't have information on 14 of those 45 patients. So these point estimates are going to have wide associated 95% confidence intervals. I didn't do it back at the napkin calculation, but it could be that even though the point estimate is a 14 percentage point difference, that these are not statistically significant. That's what we call a fragile finding, or to talk about the Christmas story, a fragile finding. What is that, Italian?
Sounds Italian to me.
That fragile finding and the emphasis in the conclusion are definitely going on hold. We're short-staffed this holiday season, so.
We need more elves. That's what we need.
Yes, we need more elves working in the OR. I don't think they're coming back until January, though, so this case will be on hold at least for the rest of my vacation.
Second that in a heartbeat. It's one of those things where I wish they had done a sensitivity analysis, right? To show, you know, how if one change in either direction or one patient was removed or one patient was added, but it would, if it would change the results or flip the results. But yeah. If we added one more elf, would that make a difference? Or we took away an elf, would that make a difference? And the answer is, it would be nice to see.
Don't ask questions you don't want answers to.
Sounds like the story of my life. All right. Honorable mentions. Personal fan favorite, perioperative identification and management of hyperglycemia in orthopedic surgery.
Your wheelhouse.
Yes, that is my wheelhouse because I am an author on that. Daniel did a fantastic job on that paper. So something to definitely read, and it gives you really good information about perioperative glycemic hyperglycemia, which we all encounter in orthopedic surgery. Autologous costal cartilage grafting for a large osteochondral lesion of the femoral head, a one-year single-arm study with 2 years of additional follow-up. By Zhang et al., it's permanently free. Development and validation of a mobile application for measuring tibial torsion, Minidol, also permanently free. Patient-reported outcome measures for acetabular fractures treated operatively without a C-arm in Ethiopia, obviously relevant if imaging is not available, by Hai Lu et al., also permanently free. Novel covert inferior pelvic approach with a subpubic plate for anterior pelvic ring fractures, preliminary results by Yuan et al. And finally,
it's covert. So it's like secret spy stuff. You had the surgery, you didn't even know it.
And it's novel covert. So it's newly covert as well too. And finally, incomplete diaphyseal atypical femoral fracture due to increased anterior lateral bowing, treatment with corrective osteotomy and intramedullary nailing with augmented plate fixation by Yun et al. It's permanently free. And there's an infographic as well too. So check these all out. Until next time, my friends.
Yeah, that's wraps it up. All these holiday gifts that we have for everyone, nicely packaged. And we'll look forward to the next episode. This is obviously covering our JBJS issue dropping December 7th. And then we'll look forward to seeing you all again December 20th for the December 21st issue.
Thanks again, everyone. Enjoy the elves.